some magical energy source that was clean and virtually unlimited, which of course would violate both of the first two laws of thermodynamics, right? So we're not going to find that. But the point is, even if we could, in terms of all the other environmental problems out there besides climate change, which were horrifying before climate change was ever acknowledged as the inconvenient truth, you know, we would have a bigger gun to shoot ourselves in the foot with that clean, unlimited source of energy. Take biodiversity. You look at the causes of species endangerment, it reads like a who's who of the American economy. More energy to fuel all those sectors, bigger gun, shoot the foot. So that's I'm just hoping that there's a great deal of realism that develops in the journalism on trying to throw money at the problems and develop new technologies to solve these fundamental problems that we have that ultimately entail limiting our macroeconomic aspirations.
Thank you, Brian. Next up, Abram.
Thanks. I'll try to be brief because I think I was the reason we're running late. I cover energy and the environment for ProPublica. I typically write about the natural gas drilling industry lately, the oil industry, and previously at Fortune, I covered the oil industry and the nuclear industry to some small extent. Give a little bit of perspective from the view of covering these issues and my take on what's needed. There was a time not too long ago where I think energy reporting was, at least for me and at certain publications, a backdoor into environmental reporting, pre-Inconvenient Truth, pre-Katrina. And now there's so much overlap, I think they're virtually synonymous. They've become very much one and the same. Energy reporting, this type of environmental reporting, is obviously an extremely important topic and extremely current. I think that that in general we all could do a better job of it, and it I think requires a bit of a higher standard than a lot of the other topics we cover. Requires a very in-depth scientific understanding, and I think a little bit more critical thinking and ability to convey the complex and nuanced issues around how many of the technologies that we try to report on work to really both make them accessible to a reader, but to be accurate, to draw accurate parallels between the life cycle of oil or a hydrocarbon-based fuel and the life cycle of a solar fuel, which has could have hazardous disposal issues or involves intensive manufacturing on either end of the renewable part of that energy. So I think that there's a challenge to be met by journalists reporting on energy and the environment. And at the same time, I think that coverage is suffering slightly disproportionately in our current news environment for energy coverage in particular. Short news cycle, soundbite culture, all lend to more superficial coverage rather than more in-depth coverage. The second main point that I wanted to touch on relates to how economic pressure affects environmental or energy coverage. I think, to some degree, a good economy, high commodity prices can exert certain kinds of pressure on energy development and coverage. But to a greater extent, a bad economy, I think, is kind of crunch time for both the energy industry and for environmental coverage of it, and is really kind of a clarion call for more intensive work. I'm speaking a bit from the context of my coverage recently of natural gas drilling, of resource extraction. But a tough economy is precisely the time when corners are cut, when environmental mistakes happen, when best practices that are otherwise followed might be put by the wayside because they're not required by regulations and they are expensive. When I see opportunities for environmental stewardship to suffer, and then at the same time that happens on an operator's side or a business side, oversight can be diminished. Government agencies see their budgets shaved. Compliance and enforcement staff are cut. a recent example in my work. You know, the price of natural gas has dropped from historic highs last year to just a couple dollars per thousand cubic feet, and with that, several of the companies that I follow closely have abandoned certain low-impact practices in the drilling fields, anything from sharing roads to a well pad to other kind of habitat restoration practices, just because they don't have to and now they can't afford to. At the same time, in New York State, the enforcement staff for Department of Minerals and Natural Resources, which is handling a massive onslaught of applications, has cut its staff by 35% in the last year. So these kind of pressures come together to, if you do the kind of critical or investigative reporting that I do, to present lots of opportunities for deeper analysis and for greater accountability for the energy industry. By that token, it's not always about pollution. It's often about legislation or just informing and engaging the public. Contracted economy presents, I think, a sense of urgency and immediacy in terms of passage of climate legislation or energy legislation or local regulations on the state level that can, in that sense of urgency, can lead to maybe a willingness to take easily accessible choices, let's say extractable resources, you know, over difficult long-term investments like greater investment in renewable energy. And I think that that's one example of an opportunity for journalists to come into the picture and kind of cool down, take a deep breath, and present a more robust, cool-headed picture to their readers that can parse out these different complicated factors.
Thank you. Jim.
I'm Jim Rogers. I'm the CEO of Duke Energy. How many people were at the plenary session yesterday with Vice President Gore? Okay, I wanted to make sure. I wanted to get a quick look so that I make sure that I tailor my comments in a way that are new and different than what you heard from me yesterday. I really agree with Abraham in this important point. Energy issues and environmental issues are inextricably linked. You can't think about one without thinking about the other, because they really, the interaction is really critical, and it's unfortunate that in Congress, the way the committees are set up, they're not set up in a way to address the issue holistically in terms of the interplay between those two sets of policies. I think that we're in the most transformative period in the history of the power industry for a variety of different reasons. I think the challenge is about innovation. I think the challenge is about R&D and deployment. But I want to make an important point, and I made it yesterday. Every decision that I make, every investment decision I make it with the assumption that cap-and-trade legislation has been passed by Congress. I make it with the assumption that COP15 is in the rearview mirror and we have a world agreement. Because we're a capital-intensive industry, we build power plants for 50 years, and I really need to have a clear vision about where the world is going, and it's inevitable in my judgment that we will regulate carbon on a national basis as well as worldwide. So that's the assumption that should frame my comments today. The second thing I would do to really frame it is to ground you in the 20th century. And if we went back to 1909, when we started down the road of providing universal access to electricity in America, which we did, it basically enabled the growth of our economy. It enabled things no one could have envisioned in 1909, whether it's computers and the internet, whether it is MRIs or x-rays or laser surgery. I mean, think of all the things that have no one could have envisioned in 1909. And if you went back to 1909 and went to the cities in 1909 and you looked at, I lived in a house built before 1900 where we burned coal in the fireplace. Oh, by the way, I wasn't living in 1909. I was told they burned coal in the fireplace. But although it might look like it. But the fact of the matter is we enabled things that no one could envision. We drove our economy, and electric rates today have been in real terms flat for 50 years. But that was about yesterday. I think the challenge that we have as an industry that's powered our economy is fundamentally different in the 20th century. And I mean, in 21st century. And let me quickly tell you what they are, because I think, in a sense, you'll see kind of how to focus the thinking in terms of drilling down on the way forward. First of all, I believe it's our mission to provide universal access to energy efficiency. Fixed income, low income, mid income, high income, small companies, big companies, and universal access to energy efficiency should be our mission. We should make our economy the most energy efficient economy in the world. That would be assignment one. Assignment two is to fundamentally decarbonize and modernize our generation fleet. Our sector has 40% of the emissions of CO2. I took a look at our fleet. Virtually all will be retired by 2050. If we can retire all those plants and replace them, we have the ability to decarbonize that fleet by 2050. I think we can do it. One, it's not going to be cheap. Two, it's not going to be easy because we need technological advances in every way we generate electricity. It's not going to be fast because it's going to take several decades, but we got to get going on it now to get it done during that time. The third one is really to facilitate the move to plug-in hybrids and electric vehicles. The transport sector represents 30% of the emissions of CO2. If we can find a way to facilitate it, we should. And in fact, the Clinton Global Initiative a couple weeks ago, we committed along with FPNL to transform our entire fleet to plug-in hybrids or electric cars between 2010 and 2020. That's 10,000 vehicles. Now, I am focused, and let me be clear about this, I am focused on solutions, but I would pursue this course even if carbon wasn't an issue. Now, think about that point. I don't want you to misread what I'm just saying. I believe carbon must be addressed. I've been an advocate for it for over a decade. I think it's a catalyst for policy changes that need to be made anyway. But let me tell you why I think those three objectives, and then I'll conclude, those three objectives must be pursued, and I would pursue them even if carbon wasn't one of the number one issues facing our society. One is, as I mentioned, we have to retire and replace these plants anyway. Let's do it in a way that reduces our carbon emission. So I would have to do that anyway, and prices would rise as a consequence as compared to the real price of electricity being flat. Secondly, with respect to the auto sector, plug-in hybrids, we need as a country to wean ourselves from the importation of oil. 70% of the oil comes from outside the United States. Good for the balance of payments, good for our economy, and at the end of the day, provides a national security that we don't have today because of our dependency on foreign oil. Thirdly, and this is the most important point to me, and I can have a longer conversation about this because this is one of my highest callings. This universal access to energy efficiency, I would do it even if carbon was not the issue. Let me tell you why. Today, there are 1.6 billion people in the world who have no access to electricity, no access to the modern world. They are going to get access to electricity. And that means more fossil fuel is going to be burned based on the technologies that are available today unless there are advances. If you think about where we are today in the world population, there's 6.5 billion people, and by 2050, there'll be 9 billion people. So there's going to be an even growing demand for electricity because look what it's done to our economy. I'm sure China, India, Africa want those same ability to have access to the things that our people have access. And I believe fundamentally that the most energy efficient economy, when we're battling over these scarce resources, increases the probability that our GDP per capita for our children and our grandchildren will be much higher if we have the most energy efficient economy in the world. So I am highly motivated to get this done. So the focus is on solutions. Carbon's an important part of it, but I'd be doing this even if carbon wasn't on the table and such an important issue to the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
She gave me an extra minute because I'm from North Carolina and I talk slow.
I think you proved otherwise.
Not that slow, Jim. Hi, I'm Catherine Hamilton. I'm president of the Gridwise Alliance, and I want to talk about smart grid. And my husband says smart grid is like bell bottoms in 1978, where everybody wants them and nobody knows what they are. The Gridwise Alliance advocates for a smarter grid for the public good, and we truly believe it's for the public good. We are a completely democratic, consensus-based coalition of over 100 organizations. Duke Energy is one of our members. We consist of independent system operators, utilities, cable and meter manufacturers, academia, investors, telecom companies, software companies, auto companies. It is an enormous breadth of companies that have all come together in a consensus fashion to figure out what do we do about the grid and how do we transform the grid, because that is a revolution that's happening, as Jim said. We look at the grid very holistically, from power plant bus bar all the way to the meter and the load center in a building. So we look at it as an entire grid. We say holistically it has to evolve, it has to change and be overlaid with a two-way communication system that on which everybody can participate, utilities, transmission companies, and consumers. We don't think a smart meter is smart unless the consumer is able to make choices about what they do. So we, in addition to working with companies, we outreach to nonprofit organizations, environmental groups, consumer groups, other trade associations that are working on similar issues that may overlap in some way. We also believe that smart grid is going to look different no matter where you are. It's not going to be, there's not one picture you can say that's, this is the smart grid, this is what it's going to look like everywhere. Different electric systems, different consumers, different areas have completely different drivers. So in a rural co-op setting, where, and co-ops, by the way, have the highest penetration of smart meters of anybody, of any other sector, because they need reliability. They have miles and miles of lines where they need to know if grandma's lights are out without having to send a truck down, and they can react quicker that way. Whereas an urban utility with a lot of consumers with a very high demand may be working on demand response technology. So different systems, different consumers, bases, it's going to look different no matter where you are, depending on the technology needs. So it's going to evolve differently. We also are completely technology neutral. We don't say you need, you know, 50 million meters. We say let's do what makes sense from an investment standpoint and from smart public policy standpoint. And we need both of those things. We need investment and good public policy. As Jim was talking about, we absolutely have to have good, stable federal energy policy. On the investment side, and I've left some handouts in the back, the stimulus package, the Recovery Act, funded about $4 billion for investment grants and demonstration, 50-50 cost share, federal government, and projects. And those projects are going to be awarded, the funding is going to be awarded in probably a couple of weeks, and we'll hear about that very soon. That is actually going to stimulate smart grid, because the folks that are going to, and the program is way oversubscribed by several times. Even the people who don't get the awards are very likely going to proceed, maybe at, not at the level that they originally were, but those projects will likely still proceed. As Jim says, Duke Power is already making investment decisions based on the future, and that's what these companies are looking at and what they're doing all over the country, in all every state they're doing this. Investment. I have also a handout on investment in back. Morgan Stanley says in the next 20 years that smart grid investment is going to multiply by 5 times. I worked for an investment company before I came to Gridwise Alliance, and clean tech and smart grid are the biggest investment opportunities right now. I mean, they really are top. So from the private investment standpoint, they're really huge. But underlying that, we have to have stable federal policy and state policy as well. But the grid is interstate, so it's going to have to be on a federal level as well, so we can deal with the grid and modernize it. So we're looking at how do you make smart grid be the series of enabling technologies to help with the cap and trade scheme, to help with the renewable portfolio standard or an energy efficiency standard? How do you have smart grid not be the end goal, because it's just a set of technologies, but to be the catalyst for getting more renewables online, for getting distributed generation, for doing energy efficiency, for getting plug-in hybrids, and for making our system more reliable and more robust and more flexible? So that's how we view it. I'm really interested to hear from a policy standpoint how we can proceed. Thanks.
Thank you. We're going to open it up to questions right away. I know that a lot of you have things to ask the panel. So a couple of reminders. SEJ members are the ones who can ask questions. If please identify yourself and your affiliation, and please no speech making. So, and use the microphone. This is recorded.
Hi, John Addison, Clean Fleet Report. As we expand the use of plug-in vehicles, how can we shape demand the charging off-peak, and what are some scenarios to, over the longer term, expand the vehicle to grid?
I think, first of all, time of day pricing would allow that, and I think that's been done in a number of states, so I think that is one way forward. I do think that as the battery technology becomes robust, we'll have the ability to actually look at a car battery as a source during peak periods. I think a car will have an identification on it, whether it's plugged in a parking lot or plugged in your home. We'll be able to track it in terms of whether you're taking power from the grid or producing power into the grid. We are working on these kinds of technologies today. We have invested money in a number of universities who are doing detailed work around this, but we believe, your question's a good one, we believe it's really critical to evolve that technology. And my last point is this. While we believe in electric vehicles is the answer, we also believe that natural gas vehicles with respect to buses and maybe trucks might make sense. So it's not one size fits all. There's kind of a blend here that might make sense over time.
Hi, Roger Witherspoon with U.S. Black Engineer Magazine. Can you have a smart grid without having a national grid or one organization that runs a national grid?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our systems are pretty connected. The independent system operators help provide those connections in different parts of the country. I think utilities are already moving forward. Independent system operators and transmission builders are already moving forward. I do think that FERC is going to need to set some guidelines for us as we move forward on what the transmission system is going to look like. And we're fairly agnostic about that as an organization. We say if you build it, make it smart, knowing that we're going to need some. Though we are going to need some more transmission and some very careful siting and cost allocation.
Let me make one important point here. You're thinking of national grid. I think the smart grid, what it does is something that we can't do today with because of the two-way communication, we'll be better able to integrate distributed generation. We have a solar panel on the rooftop program in North Carolina. We have the better ability to integrate that intermittent power source with a smart grid. If we have battery technologies that we put at our substations, we'll be better able to integrate there. If we write a software for our customers, so our customers optimizing their use, we'll be able to take the optimization of that customer's use of electricity along with all their neighbors, understand that algorithm, and optimize it against the utility grid. So smart grid is really critical for optimization at that level more than between different systems that are interconnected to the major grid.
Stephanie Hemphill, Minnesota Public Radio. Change the subject briefly, hopefully briefly. Brian Chick, what does a steady state economy look like?
Well, it looks a lot like a growing economy, except in the sense that it is dynamic. You know, you have economic conditions, supplies, and demands changing all the time. The big distinction is that it's sustainable. Clearly, a growing economy is not. You know, to think that there is no limit to economic growth on a finite landmass is mathematically precisely equivalent to saying that you can have a steady state economy, a non-growing, non-declining, mildly fluctuating economy, on a perpetually diminishing landmass, so that eventually you could have the $53 trillion global economy under the table here, leaving the rest of the world as designated wilderness area. Well, it's ludicrous, and it's precisely mathematically as ludicrous as thinking there's no limit. So in terms of what a steady state economy is, that's the first thing. It's sustainable. It's not a failed growth economy. It's an economy where the fiscal, monetary, and trade policy levers are set intentionally and gradually, not in shocking fashion, but gradually ramped back towards stabilizing population and per capita production and consumption in the aggregate. That's it in a nutshell. The list of fiscal policy tools and the tax codes and budgets is very long. In terms of, I'm not sure what else you're wondering about in terms of what it would look like, but finally I might say, look outside. What does that economy look like? Imagine it's stable and not subject to the casino-like effects of wild-eyed growth that brought our monetary sector way out of kilter with the real production, and brought your for sale signs all over the residential areas. That part you wouldn't see in a steady state economy.
Hi, I'm Sarah Peach. I'm a freelance journalist based in North Carolina, and so my question is for you, Mr. Rogers. I'm curious about what your carbon stances mean to your bottom line. Is it costing Duke Energy to be more carbon conscious?
I think at the end of the day, and this is, politicians don't like to talk about this, but the reality is, as I said, the price of electricity, actually in the last 15 years in real terms has fallen, but over 50 years has been flat. As we transform, as we invest, for instance, in renewables, which are about 150% of the avoided cost of regular generation, as we invest in smart grid, and we've got $1 billion projected over 5 years to invest in smart grid, as we invest in retiring existing plants and building new plants, the price of electricity is going to go up. And what nobody wants to talk about, they think we can do this without any increase in pricing. I didn't even mention the cost of complying with a carbon regime. The prices are going to go up in every event. That is a reality. And one of the reasons I'm such an advocate for universal access to energy efficiency, I want to get ahead of the inevitable rise in energy prices so that I can help my customers bring their demand down so that the bill at the end of the day doesn't go up as much as the price is going to go up. And they won't be as frustrated because they'll have some control over their usage. But the unfortunate reality is prices will go up. And carbon is just another incremental add to it, but they're going to go up anyway.
Yeah, I'd love to add something to that. Baltimore Gas and Electric just did a whole bunch of studies, and they've done a pilot. And they say with $165 per kW invested in a peak demand reduction program that has energy efficiency as well, that compares to $1,000 a kW to build a natural gas-fired peaker plant. So the cost is significantly less to do efficiency and smart grid than it is to build plants. And then the savings, what they produce is actually they can sell back as generation to the PJM system, so they can sell it back into the market without having to build another plant.
You said that, Mr. Rogers, you said that you're trying to get ahead of these rising prices. Have you had any pushback from shareholders on that?
No, because I've been very direct with our shareholders. And in fact, before the merger that created Duke, our annual report in 2004 was totally focused on climate change. The term, we said, can we find common ground on global warming? That's how it was talked about in 2004. Now we talk about it as climate change. But we have been focused on this for a long time. We've told our investors with respect to it. And quite frankly, I think they get it. They don't see this as an impediment to our growth. The important thing is to be able to do it in a smart way and have the ability to recover the cost of the investment to allow us to comply with incremental carbon regulations and with these incremental costs that we will actually incur. I want to continue to make the distinction. While the rates may go up, even with energy efficiency investments, the usage levels can go down. But I don't want to make the mistake of saying net-net, your bill is going to be lower, because that's not so clear, because every investment in energy efficiency may or may not deliver the reduction in usage.
A question for Mr. Rogers, and then one that others. Oh, Art Hackett from Wisconsin Public Television. Others can answer if they want. You talked about your fleet being carbon neutral by 2050. Do you know, or can you tell me, how your fuel breakdown will break down then compared to what it is now, coal, nuclear, alternative? And the other question is Duke a loner, an outlier on this idea of decarbonization, or is everyone doing this in the utility industry?
I think we were, actually my annual report in 1993, we just finished the Clean Air Act amendments, and I said at that point we need to turn to carbon because that's the issue on the horizon. So I think that we've probably, from a public policy standpoint, have led on this issue. But when I was chairman of EEI, I was able to bring a consensus together where our industry fundamentally changed and said, we believe there ought to be mandatory regulation of CO2. However, I think people recognize it. I'm not sure. Most people are kind of frozen because there's no regulation yet. There's no price on carbon. There's no cap on emissions. So a lot of people are running their businesses saying, well, we'll wait and see. And I might be a little bit in the place of leading on that issue. I don't know. I think some think about it that way. But it's easy to envision how leaders of companies would be, well, we're not acting until Congress acts. We're not acting until there's a COP15 action. So I think the majority are probably waiting for legislation. We're in a position that believes that we need to start to move now. We're one of the largest generators of electricity in the country. We're the third largest generator from coal, third largest generator from nuclear, which really goes to your first question. I try to envision 2050, and it's very hard for me to envision what the mix will be for this reason. Every technology we have today needs to get fixed. With coal, we need CCS, either sequestration or reuse of the carbon. With natural gas, which people think is the answer, it has 50% of the carbon footprint of coal, and there's questions with respect to the actual environmental impact of the 600 TCF people believe that will come from unconventional shale sources. So that's a whole
600 TCF.
Yes, that's what they're projecting. Actually, John Podesta and Tim Worth wrote an
article. What does that mean?
That's 600 trillion cubic feet. Today, we use about 22 trillion cubic feet a year of natural gas in the United States. So there is arguments being made that that's a partial answer. Not clear yet. With respect to nuclear, you still have the issue of spent fuel, and with the uncertainty with respect to that and recycling. So every one of these alternatives have what I call further technological developments to be an equal, underscore this word, equal contributor in a low-carbon world. Even wind and solar needs battery technologies or integrated with gas to be an equal contributor because we have to provide power 24/7.
Yeah, I'd like to add something to this discussion. It's wonderful to see people very passionate about increasing energy efficiency, and it's very helpful, but Jim's focus is on that, and focuses on solutions, and it seems, however, to disregard any notion of macroeconomic solutions. And this is related to your question, and John, I remember you asked a question yesterday in Andy Revkin's breakfast discussion about what the odds were of avoiding a 2%, 2 degree Celsius, much less a 4 degree Celsius rise by 2100. And remember, the reason that's not going to happen is this obsession with economic growth among nation states and the international community. So I think there are solutions, but they're not efficiency does not suffice.
Can I make
one? Macroeconomic solution that's part of this. A failure to cap and thenceforth trade is really a failure to cap because people recognize that capping, essentially, when it comes to energy, is a cap on economic growth.
I don't think it's a cap on economic growth. Let me tell you, I heard him earlier, and I kind of resisted the temptation, but since he jumped in, I am not resisting the temptation any longer. Here's an important point. We can't sell the American people on a no-growth scenario. We have to recognize something very fundamental about future generations. We have today, our economy, we reduce 3% a year the energy intensity of our economy. We actually are decarbonizing our economy 3% each year. Not enough, quite frankly, to address climate change, but we're on that trajectory. Until 1994, the growth in electric demand and the GDP were one by one because we were increasingly an energy-intensive economy. The energy intensity of our economy was tied to GDP growth. Today, the growth in electricity is only 50% of GDP growth because the character of our economy has changed and we're still being able to grow, but in different ways than through energy-intensive manufacturing. So I think it's a very important point to make. If we try to sell the notion that our economy can't grow in a low-carbon world, it makes it harder to sell to the American people because they are accustomed to seeing GDP growth per capita over the last 50 years.
Hey, that reminds me of the economist that observed about a decade ago that only 3% of GDP had to do with agriculure.
Okay. I actually have a question, and I'll get you one second. Moderator's prerogative here. I've been burning to ask this question from of Abram about his opening remarks regarding scientific research. And I know that I talked to you a while ago, and you said you spent a lot of time with scientific journals. And can you talk about that, the role of reading scientific journals and reporting on energy and what, you know, they're talking about with the different growth in industries. What, you know, what is that role in your reporting on the science?
Oh, sure. Total change of gears. I think that to get a sufficient background knowledge when you come into a subject from a reporting standpoint, and you may not be a long-time expert in the subject of smart grid or what have you, in my experience, I rely extremely heavily on scientific journals, on environmental reports, on government reports. So I go deeply into whatever literature is available, and personally go through. I think this is my personal style, but go through a quite intensive study period before I kind of emerge from that and am prepared to give a call to folks like Mr. Rogers and have an informed conversation. I think that ramp up is much steeper and much longer for energy and environment reporting, for science reporting, than anything else that I've ever reported.
And
on.
Is there one source that you use more than another for journal?
It would completely vary depending on the topic, except to say, aside from scientific journals that I rely heavily on the trade press, especially for the oil and gas industry. I think that there's a lot of great material and very smart reporting coming out of those niche publications.
I just want to make sure that everybody here is getting enough information on sources for their reporting of stories. So thank you.
I'm Todd Neff. I'm a freelance journalist in Denver. Back to the grid, essentially. With Catherine and Jim, you have something to add. Be great. The first question has to do with balancing. You mentioned natural gas being required to balance because of intermittency. Renewable sources. Could a really smart grid balance wind and solar, for example, potentially well enough that you wouldn't necessarily need to fire natural gas plants? And the second has to do with the political and jurisdictional issues with expanding a grid across the country. And I know FERC is working on this kind of thing, but I'd be interested in knowing kind of where that process is, because you have local municipalities, you've got counties, everybody's kind of got a foot in the door when it comes to the grid.
Yeah, I'd love to take on the renewable issue. With renewables, there are some game-changing technologies out there that are going to really be helpful. And we need dynamic forecasting so that we'll be able to understand when wind is available so that we can cycle it on. And we also need energy storage technologies. Those are going to be really important in order for us not to have spinning reserves that are not as clean as renewables. So those are things that we consider integral parts of a smart grid, and that and then there are other pieces like wireless dispatch systems that can bring wind online very quickly, and that's all part of smart grid too. But we feel like that's all part of that system, and that, yes, you will be able to balance, hopefully, with electric vehicles, with the demand side, which is why we need two-way communication all along the grid. But we also need to continue on the path of R&D so we can get some of these game-changing technologies.
I really agree with that. I would add one other thing. And this is a longer conversation, but I'm at a place where I hear politicians talk about wind and how critical it is, and we'll build these long transmission lines across the country. My answer to them is, when you tell me that, and then I ask you about siting, most of them say, oh, well, we'll figure out the siting. I think the sense of urgency we need to address this issue and bring renewables in is so critical that the time for half measures is at an end. And when somebody talks about renewables and they don't talk about eminent domain, because I'm solution-oriented, so that we can build the line to bring the power to where the load is, they're not, from my standpoint, they're just telling a story. They're not presenting policy that produces solutions. So my view is you've got to solve this eminent domain as part of it if wind is going to be in it. So I think that's a very that's just an add-on to what she said.
Two questions.
Can you identify yourself,
yes,
please?
Yep. My name is Andrew Nicky Fork. I'm a business and an environmental journalist from Calgary, Alberta. My first question has to do with sort of the energy water nexus, that's what it's called. But basically, it's the phenomenon that we use a lot of water to produce hydrocarbons, and we use a lot of hydrocarbons to treat and move water. And it seems to me that the development of unconventional hydrocarbons has rather dramatic implications for groundwater. So I wonder if Abram could talk really about the unconventional shale gas plays and the implications for groundwater in the United States. Second question, and
it's a general. Can we go for the first question?
Oh, okay, sure. All right.
Oh, sure. I've spent much of the last year looking at the impacts of both the underground processes of drilling for natural gas and their effects on groundwater and the above ground impacts of the waste from that process on surface water. Looking particularly at a process called hydraulic fracturing, which is used in both oil and gas drilling in oil drilling to recover reserves in leftover oil fields, and in gas drilling, particularly to break up the rock and release this gas and allow it to flow up to the surface. My impression, the results of my reporting show that there's really a lack of, I think, scientific understanding about what the geological implications are deep underground. There's not necessarily a clear record or explanation to show exactly how contaminants may move underground or to prove that contaminants have moved into aquifers, but there's a couple situations in which there is groundwater contamination that can't be easily attributed to any other source, and EPA is undergoing a process of investigating that I've been tracking. In terms of water usage, it's a large issue across the United States, but particularly on the East Coast in the Marcellus Shale, where New York and Pennsylvania are grappling with a type of hydraulic fracturing that's much more water intensive than in other parts of the country, requiring as much as 8 million gallons per well. That water has to be drawn from a source, which presents the risk of depleting freshwater sources, usually surface water sources. And then once that water is used, it's contaminated both with the fluids and additives that the industry uses for their process, and all sorts of natural contaminants that are picked up deep, thousands of feet underground. In East Coast cases, that water is almost always discharged back into our streams and rivers, usually through a municipal wastewater treatment plant that may or may not have the ability to remove some of the contaminants that are in it. So the big picture is, while we're looking at a region, particularly in the east, that isn't particularly that isn't grappling with a water shortage, I think that the nation as a whole is beginning to recognize the importance of water and the limited resource of water, and the prospect of large scale ramp up and expansion and development of natural gas presents the opportunity for a very substantial impact on those water resources that isn't, as far as I see, a large enough part of the planning and regulatory and cleanup process.
Can I drop just a footnote? Last year I co-authored at the World Economic Forum an article on water. Water is going to be the next oil in this century. And how we think about water is really going to be there's going to be a need for a fundamental change in how we think about water usage around the world, and it's really a local specific type of issue. But his points are really points well made with respect to the unconventional gas plays.
I agree totally with what both you guys just said. You got a lot of good facts, and that's a good point, but there seems to be a bit of a cognitive dissonance, and frankly, it's present nonstop in the media. We recognize that there is a first law of thermodynamics. You can't make something out of nothing. This water shortage is real. This oil, peak oil, is a real phenomenon. You can't get perpetually more efficient due to the second law of thermodynamics. So we should be on the same page. There is a limit to economic growth, and we're seeing it manifesting in our times. And one more thing about this economic growth business, there's also something called uneconomic growth, which is when the costs of the next unit of growth are greater than the benefits we derive from it. And there is much in the ecological economics literature already published that suggests that we've been in the age of uneconomic growth since anywhere from the 1950s to the 1970s. And think about your families, your cultural experience, so forth. See if that doesn't resonate with you.
What's your second question?
Second question is a short one. Ivan Illich, a Catholic theologian, wrote a great book in the 1970s called Energy Inequity, the first so-called peak oil crisis, and where he suggested that you know, we are all entitled to certain amounts of energy, but beyond that, then we're blowing the budget. And so he made a comment in the book. He said, well, we can't solve the energy crisis by consuming more energy, so I'll just throw this little one out for you. So.
Question.
Yes.
Chad Cohen, I'm an executive producer with the Discovery Channel. I'm just wondering how much business has to play in this whole larger discussion, particularly when it comes to increasingly more people pulling out of the Chamber of Commerce, what kind of effect does that have on the discourse in Washington? And not to put you on the spot, Mr. Rogers, what is that something that you're considering?
That's a good question. I've come to believe that public policy in the future will be shaped by NGOs, foundations, and corporations. I was a founding member of USCAP, and we had a call for action 2.5 years ago. We wrote a blueprint. I talked about it yesterday. And that blueprint for the way forward on climate was by and large adopted by Chairman Waxman and his committee. And that was something that was generated not from the government, but was generated from NGOs and foundations and corporations working together. Our company has withdrawn from ACCCE because we reached a point where we didn't think that we could move them to a place to support climate legislation. We withdrew from the National Association of Manufacturers because we believe we couldn't move them to a place. We have not moved out of the chamber for a very clear reason. We still have hope that we can move them to a more centered position that support it. But the U.S. Chamber is fundamentally different than the Roundtable and other organizations. There's a U.S. Chamber in every community in this country. They represent Main Street America. And at the end of the day, we need to shape the businesses on Main Street with respect to this issue if we're going to really get real traction. So I've opted to stay in, and maybe it's hope-trumping experience, but my belief is that I can shape their thinking and moving them more to support climate in a way that makes sense for our planet.
I would just add really briefly that from my perspective, I think the power and strength of business as a lobby, general business as a lobby in Washington, tends to shape regulatory proposals and so forth to their liking, and as a result, the greatest change or the greatest improvement or progress tends to come not when government has stepped in most recently to force action, but when businesses take a leadership role or find that there's opportunities in innovation to further their business objectives and environmental objectives at the same time, and that's where the greatest movement has been in recent years.
Again, my name is Sarah Peach. I'm a freelancer in North Carolina. Mr. Rogers, you've shared your commitment to making the economy the most energy efficient in the world. If we're talking about energy efficiency, I'm curious about why Duke Energy is building a new coal-fired power plant at Cliffside instead of pursuing efficiency gains in North Carolina.
Sure. Two things. One is 2.5 years ago, we filed for our Save a Watt proposal so we could aggressively jumpstart energy efficiency in the state. And it's still pending, although we finally got approval from all the parties and we're waiting for action. Secondly, let me talk directly to Cliffside. Cliffside is a plant that's a supercritical plant. We call it a bridge plant. We're building the plant because it's an 800-megawatt plant, and it's in an area of the state that is off of the Catawba watery. And because of water issues there. The most important thing about building that plant is this. We will shut down, it's 800 megawatts, we will shut down 1,000 megawatts of 50 to 60-year-old plants. So our SOx, NOx, mercury footprint will go from looking like this to looking like that, which are local pollutants. Secondly, we committed to cap our CO2 emissions as a consequence of building it. And thirdly, the carbon intensity of our project, because of the efficiency of that unit of our product, will drop significantly because of the building of that plant. We're also building a coal plant in the Midwest, but it's the world's largest coal gasification with the potential for CCS. So we view that as a bridge plant. We believe that it reduces our carbon intensity, but equally important, it reduces the other pollutants, which are really local, SOx, NOx, and mercury.
I think many people would applaud the fact that you're shutting down these older plants, but considering that North Carolina's energy demand is flatlined or declining, doesn't it seem like a half measure? As you were saying, it's not the time for half measures to then build a new plant as well that will stay up for 50 years.
I think the way I think about it is this. I have to balance affordability, reliability, and clean power 24/7. And this is one of those trade-offs where I don't have the luxury of looking at this purely through the lens of clean and letting that be the primary driver of my decision. I have to look at it also through the lens of affordability and reliability. And even though demand is flat, think about it, I'm shutting down 1,000 megawatts and only building 800. And so it kind of recognizes a realignment of a future growth and demand in the state by taking that step. But again, it's a balancing act, and I wish I had the luxury of some environmental groups of saying to hell with affordability, to hell with reliability, let's stay focused on clean. I just don't have that luxury.
Sarah Vague, I'm a freelancer and a student at the University of Minnesota. And we've talked a lot about carbon, both in this panel and at this conference at large and its role in a new energy policy, but how do the environmental impacts of fuel source extraction impact energy policy now and the conversation in the future as there's a push for example, green jobs? And I'd like to hear, especially from Mr. Rogers, as you know, 30% of the electricity generation in North Carolina comes from mountaintop removal mined coal, which is a serious concern to a lot of environmental reporters, including myself.
Well, I had the good fortune of growing up in Kentucky and knowing a little bit about coal mining. I personally think that mountaintop mining should be in the rearview mirror. Today, we're in a situation where virtually 70% of our electricity comes from coal. All our coal in the Midwest doesn't come from mountaintop mining. It's just in North Carolina, and it has to do with proximity. And I've really asked my team to take a look at what if we moved away from suppliers that supplied us from as a consequence of mountaintop mining. It would translate into much higher prices in our product as these contracts expire. But I clearly think that the EPA is going to act on mountaintop mining. I think there's going to be a transition. But at the end of the day, it will translate into higher prices for consumers in North Carolina as we move away from it. But I'm a guy that believes that this is being addressed by EPA. And at the end of the day, mountaintop mining is either going to be regulated in a more stringent way or eliminated.
I'd like to add, with regard to environmental impacts, this reminds me, my PhD research was on the causes of species endangerment in the United States. And, you know, what escapes attention too often and what I wish the media would pick up on more is that the economy has a structure. It's similar to the economy of nature. It's founded upon energy and agricultural and extractive sectors. Like Adam Smith wrote about in The Wealth of Nations, you have to have agricultural and extractive surplus to free the hands for the division of labor and make all the other sectors, including information, meaningful and relevant and able to run. So it comes into play in energy decision-making when an energy field is being developed and it endangers a species. Technically, pursuant to the Endangered Species Act, that project will not ensue. Then there is the option of the God Squad assembling and overruling the existence of that species and allowing the development of the energy. What I can tell you from experience in public service is that the Endangered Species Act is an implicit prescription for a steady state economy, albeit one with many species teetering on the brink, okay? And because it is recognized more and more as something that shuts sectors and projects down, is not enforced. So you're going to see, they talk about the sixth great extinction crisis that we're in. It's because there's no solution being provided in macroeconomic policy. And one last thing, I tend to agree that NGOs and foundations are going to be steering policy. The Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, for example, has a position that the non-journalists among you can sign, like E.O. Wilson and Vandana Shiva and David Suzuki and Paul Ehrlich, etc., and that 100 organizations have endorsed, that calls for an end to this uneconomic growth and readjusting back toward a steady state. It's in the back of the room, and I encourage all of you out there to sign it.
I just wanted to add to answer the question. I think there's a little bit of a disconnect between the policymaking, energy policymaking, and understanding the environmental impacts of extractive resources, especially when it comes to water. I mean, mountaintop removal has been a very high-profile subject in the last couple of years. Less part of the conversation is the amount of chemicals, benzene, diesel, that are used to float that coal and to clean that coal that ends up in the slurries and in water sources. The same with oil. oil and gas, and the single largest waste source or waste product of the oil and gas industry is produced water, mostly more from oil than gas, and its volumes are astounding, and that doesn't really get discussed, and it's not a part of the early policymaking planning. It seems to be something that comes out years later when there's an alleged health cluster or something that's very disassociated from the decision to pursue those resources in the first place. I think that the conversation leans a little too heavily on the issue of emissions. How much carbon? What's the carbon content of wind energy or coal energy or gas energy? And doesn't look enough at the full life cycle implications of a lot of these different energy sources.
I really agree with that life cycle comment. That is really, and the water issue is really critical.
We have these last two questions, and then we'll wrap it up.
Stephanie Hemphill, Minnesota Public Radio. I'm trying to understand why some businesses embrace a carbon-constrained or post-carbon future and other businesses are still kicking and screaming. And Jim Rogers, are you more comfortable with it because your customers are right here in the U.S. and you don't have to compete on a global scale? And what do you say to your colleagues in the chamber, to the folks who haven't come to the place where you are or in different industries, to try to bring them along? And I'm addressing it to you, but I'm sure others have responses too.
Well, first of all, we don't just supply power in the U.S. We have a very large operation in South America where we supply 4,000 megawatts of generation there, primarily in Brazil, Argentina, and Peru. But 75% of our generation in South America is hydro. So I love the carbon footprint of that operation compared to the carbon footprint of our operation in North America. I think that the way I say it is this, and Dan D'Amico, who is the CEO of Nucor, which is a large steel manufacturer, you know, the steel industry has been very much against this. He sits on my board. Actually, he sits on my compensation committee, so it makes the conversations more difficult. But the fact of the matter is this. He asked me to go address the steel manufacturers, and I did research on it. And one of the things that I learned is that our steel industry in this country has the lowest carbon intensity of any steel industry in the world. Part of it is because they converted those arc blast furnaces to electrotechnology, and Nucor is an example of that. As a consequence of that, they don't have the same emissions footprint on carbon as the steel industry in other parts of the world. So in a sense, as we move into a low-carbon world and there's constraints on carbon, assuming everybody participates, and the big question I always hear is, what about China? But at the end of the day, I think it forces our industries to start to prepare, and the steel industry, which is really critical to our country, is really well positioned. So, again, I serve the industrial Midwest as well as the Southeast, and I say that we will be able to make this transition, and through a combination of investments and energy efficiency, et cetera, that we are going to minimize the cost increases that come, and there will be cost increases, but that is not going to is what's going to make you non-competitive vis-a-vis manufacturers in other parts of the country. It's labor cost, it's other cost components, not power cost.
Chad Cohn again with Discovery Channel. In terms of clean tech and smart grid opportunities, How late are we in this game, and how much can Americans actually contribute in terms of wind, solar, and batteries, and all of the opportunities are out there? It just seems that we're getting our lunches eaten. How much opportunity is there?
First of all, we're in a period in history where we have a glut of wind turbines, we have a glut of solar panels in the world. The Chinese lead the world in the production of solar panels and wind turbines and batteries. I think that it's a mistake for us to talk about the green jobs that will be produced from renewables. I think it's a mistake because it misleads the number that will actually be created. I think it's much smarter for us to say in this country, every job is a green job. Because at the end of the day, if we have that mindset, that is going to help people be more supportive. I mean, the Pew Center just did a study, and of the 20 top issues that the American people thought Congress should face, climate change was number 20. And so I believe that we run the risk of misleading the American people by saying we're going to create all these green jobs, because anybody that studies the economics of the manufacture of solar and wind panels and all know, and I'm on the board of Applied Materials, which, by the way, produces the equipment that makes thin film solar. So I've spent a lot of time understanding where the market is. And by the way, all their plants are in China. And so importantly, and I did an op-ed for the New York Times on this, there are other ways to think about this in a broader way. But if you take a message out of what you hear from me today, take this message. We need to have the mantra that every job is a green job. It will make our economies more sustainable. Every individual will be engaged in it. We will start to think about it in a way of, how do I reduce the carbon footprint within my job or the pollutants? And there are lots of examples of companies who have said that we need to do a better job of managing our waste. And again, I think if every job is a green job, it will fundamentally transform not only what we value and what we do every day, but will truly produce real results in terms of our, not just our carbon footprint, but the broader footprint.
There's another way to answer that question about how much opportunity is there. From an ecologically economic perspective, you can say on the other side of the coin of that question, how much biodiversity do you want to retain? You know, the more energy you demand into production, which then fuels all these agricultural, extractive, manufacturing, and service sectors, the less biodiversity you'll have at the end of the day for your kids and grandkids and their economy.
We're going to wrap it up now, but before we do, I'm going to ask each of our panelists here to give a one-minute just wrap up if you want to make any closing comments. So go ahead. I'm going to start at that end and go this way this time.
Okay. I actually want to make a point based on what Brian just said, which is I don't think that economic stimulus necessarily means creating jobs. It can also mean training people to do things at a higher value than they're doing now and learning new skills. So I think you can grow your economy without having to do to build more. For example, on the grid in Minnesota, Great River Energy, which is a large co-op there, decided to do digital dispatch systems for wind turbines. And they could have hired a whole bunch of contractors to come in and build those systems, and that would have been job creation. Instead, they decided to retrain all their line workers to be able to install, operate, and maintain those. So now they have people who have craft skills in operating an electromechanical system as well as digital communication skills, which is very, very important. That keeps jobs in Minnesota very high-paying jobs. It raises the level of their competencies and their skills, and it doesn't do anything to adversely impact biodiversity or the environment. It's simply helping our economy. Thanks.
Yeah. I would come back and say, remember the three aspirations or three missions that I mentioned at the beginning of the modernization, decarbonization of our fleet. Secondly, universal access to energy efficiency, and that's an hour and a half conversation to really get into what that really means. And thirdly, moving to electrical vehicles and plug-in hybrids is really should be a top priority, and I think we can do all those things. But when I talk to policymakers on the Hill, and I've spent more than my fair share of time there, I am so focused on solutions because of the assumption that we're going to live in a low-carbon world, and I'm building a bridge to a low-carbon world. And my message is simply this, and I said it a moment ago, the time for half measures is at an end. Don't talk to me about wind without talking to me about eminent domain. don't talk to me about renewables because the goal line is not renewables. The goal line is low carbon. So let's have a low carbon standard, energy efficiency, wind, solar, nuclear. They're all zero greenhouse gases.
Okay. I was told.
Green jobs, green jobs. Every job's a green job. Red room, red room, red room.
On a slightly narrower closing point, I mean, everything that I think we're talking about at this panel and a lot of this entire conference is about emissions and stems from this realization that at some point our energy consumption habits have led to some great mistake that has resulted in the harm of our atmosphere. And what I'm about to say applies much more to extractive industries than other renewables, but I think that it's incumbent on the media especially, but on people in general, to carefully examine whether the decisions, some rushed, some not, that we make going forward in terms of our energy policy might lead to that similar kind of long-term impact on different resources, namely water, is what I think about, as our past policies have on air and the atmosphere.
Thank you.
Less than 1 minute. I agree with Catherine that there can be a sustainable qualitative economic development, but when we stick to the standard textbook, publicly relevant, publicly resonant, and policy relevant definition of economic growth, that is increasing production and consumption of goods and services in the aggregate, there's clearly a limit to it, and there's clearly a conflict between economic growth and environmental protection. And the thought that I would like to leave folks with, the soundbite-ish thing, as hard as I try to get one, it's hard to get a soundbite on this stuff, but a penny saved is a penny earned, and a dollar spent is a dollar burned. That is, some type of fuel is combusted and goes into production that has a footprint.
Thank you, everybody, for being here and for all your great questions.